We're going to be in Colossians chapter 1, but before we get there, I'd ask you a question. How big is your God? Okay? And before you answer that, you need to be honest with yourself, right? We know the right answer. Our God's really big. He's all powerful, right? His power is total. He's omnipresent, so he's everywhere. If you didn't know this, when you're everywhere all at once, it means you're big, okay? Like really big, okay? He's omniscient, means he knows everything. Not only is he all powerful and he's everywhere, but he's really smart. Okay, and we know that. I don't think people here are going to argue with me. Okay, good for us. We know the truth that God's really big. But do we actually know that really big God? Okay, so you might know the truth, but do you actually know him? Is the God that you believe in, the God that you follow, the God that you claim to know, actually really big? Do you see him that way? Okay? God's really big. And then human beings, we desire to be amazed. Okay? We want to see incredible, beautiful, powerful things, shocking things. We go to great lengths. We actually spend like millions of dollars a year and travel thousands of miles to behold and experience things that will leave us with some sense of awe. Unfortunately, those things are always short-lived and they're few and far between. We're usually disappointed. They're insufficient. So we seek the awesome, but we find ourselves settling for the unexceptional. The word awesome has kind of become watered down, but the real definition is an overwhelming feeling of reverence, admiration, and it's produced by that which is grand, sublime, magnificent, and extremely powerful. It carries with it the idea of fear and daunting. Okay, so that's what we want. We want that. We want to experience that. We want to know that. But very little of what we know in this world, very little of what we experience can really be described by that word. Okay? What's frustrating in both my own life and in the lives of others is that I don't think that people are going to disagree with me on those points. Okay, one, God's really big. Two, we want to be awed. We want to see amazing and incredible things. I don't think people are going to disagree with me. Yep, we know it. We desire it. Okay, well then go to God and be amazed and have awe and experience that. Okay, we'll do it. No, we need to actually see him as big, see him as grand. We need to be excited that we can know him, excited that we can experience him. We should want more and more of him. It should be our greatest desire. And again, we know it. But so often we don't actually do it. Okay? We need to see him as he really is. Then our lives will change. The things that we turn to for amazement, the things that we attempt to find awe in, the things that we think are going to fulfill us, leave us disappointed. But God won't. He truly is awesome. He's really great, powerful, magnificent, incredible. I spent a lot of time actually looking at thesauruses, trying to find synonyms for amazing, great, and all of that. And I just stopped because no matter how many adjectives you use, they don't come close to describing who God is. So it was kind of just a waste of my time. So you'll get sick of hearing those same words over and over in the next 40 minutes or so. But sorry. But adjectives stretched to their furthest fail to even begin to capture the glory of God or describe how much higher he is than us. Yet it seems that although we might say we know that, we don't live in that reality. Instead, I think we can settle for the mundane, mediocre, monotonous. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that our life will be this high excitement day after day after day. But if we're not careful, those days of monotony, they turn into weeks, weeks into months, months into years, and before we know it, an entire lifetime has passed away without us ever really experiencing the awe, amazement, greatness, and power of our Creator. We won't have experienced being entirely overwhelmed by His love. That's the hope for today, is to rediscover or initially find a real awe of who God is. And having that is going to change your perspective. It'll change your outlook. It'll change your actions. It'll change your desires. It'll change your whole life. And to do that, we're going to look at Colossians chapter 1, verse 9. Okay? Colossians chapter 1, starting verse 9. For this reason, we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of His will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing Him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. So you read those couple verses and you might think, what does this have to do with the wonder of God? What does this have to do with understanding how big God is? Well, here you see Paul. He expresses his wish that the church, the people in Colossae, would be filled with all wisdom, spiritual understanding, knowledge. And then if you know the Bible, we know that the Bible says, actually no less than 6 distinct times, that it's the fear of the Lord that leads to understanding, that leads to full knowledge. Proverbs 9:10 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. So fear of God is something we should have. And that includes reverence. It includes respect. It includes this awe that we're talking about. But it's also going to mean real fear, right? If you understand the power of who God is, if you understand the holiness of who He is, if you understand the expectations that He has, there'll be some fear. Psalm 2:11 says, serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. So serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. So we see here that this fear and joy, they're not disconnected. Fear and joy not only can exist at the same time, but they must. So you're not going to have this awe of God, this amazement at who He is, a wonder of His power, if you don't have a knowledge of who God actually is. Paul says to be filled with wisdom and knowledge, to be filled. And you're not going to be amazed if you don't know Him. And you're not going to know Him without actual work. There's no shortcuts. If you want to know God, if you want to experience all of who He is, you're going to have to spend time reading the Bible. You're going to have to think, contemplate on His word. You're also going to have to commit yourself to a church, to a body of believers, where the character of God can more fully be displayed. You won't know all of who He is if you don't find yourself involved with other Christians. Again, there's no shortcuts for that. But then verse 10 tells us why any of this really matters. Okay, why does this actually matter? It says that we may walk in a manner that is worthy. So you read that and you're like, oh, so we can do all the right stuff, right? So I can have the right outward actions. I can go through these steps and walk in a manner that is worthy. That's why I should have the knowledge. That'd be missing the point. It says, not just to walk in a manner that is worthy, but you're doing all of that pleasing Him. Okay, we're seeking to please Him. We're bringing glory to Him. So you don't do this, you don't chase this high, this awe, this amazement because of who you are, or, you know, thinking that you're going to feel really great. You don't chase some emotion. No, you actually chase God because you care about Him, and then you will know Him and experience this awe that we're talking about. Okay, verse 11 says, strengthened with all might according to His glorious power for all patience and long suffering with joy. So here we see reference to Jesus' glorious power, glorious power of Jesus. Remember, we're talking about how magnificent He is, how high above us that He is. Okay? When you're talking about the power of Jesus, it's hard to do that because there's nothing that you can compare it to. All the power that everyone has, whether that be positionally, because of the position they have, or physically, due to their strength, doesn't come close to being able to even be compared to the power that Christ has. Okay, now don't lose me here. We're going to get into math. I know you students are like, what, school's over for the semester? No, we're going to do some math. This will be fun. Now, power, physically speaking, power, you know, take a physics class, defined as the ability to do work. Okay, the ability to do work. So you have a 25-watt light bulb, and that's a little bit of power. Watts measures power. You have your furnace at home, which is running a lot today because it's like way too cold for May. You have maybe 10,000 watts, so that's a decent amount of power. And people have the ability to produce power as well. So remember, we're talking about how far God is beyond us, that he's beyond comprehension. Maybe you read the most recent pastor's blog from Pastor Justin. If you did, you'd have seen that he mentioned a man who currently holds the record for the strongest man on earth. Like half poor. I don't know. He just had to write it. I had to pronounce it. I think that's how you say his name, though. So he's the strongest man on earth. So if you take one of his records, you can actually calculate the amount of power that he can produce. At one point, he lifted like 1,400 pounds. He deadlifted 1,400 pounds, which is pretty insane. And then you take, you know, do some math, and you'll find that that is roughly equivalent to 1,800 watts. Okay, 1,800 watts. But he only did that for like 2 seconds. So that's not that special. He powered a 60-watt light bulb, a 60-watt light bulb for about a minute. That's how much power he produced. Okay, so even the strongest man on earth doesn't produce that much power. Now, there are some who can do a little bit more. The highest sustained power output by an athlete that I could find is held by a Tour of France biker, Bradley Wiggins. So he can hold a steady output of 420 watts. That's when he's biking top speed, 420 watts. And when they bike, they go in about 6-hour shifts, maybe 7 in a day. So we'll say 7. The most that he might do in a day would be 7. So we'll say 7. And then we'll say that he could do that top speed for the full 7 hours, which he can't. He can't. But we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Okay? And then do some math, and you find that he could power a 60-watt light bulb for 49 hours. That's not too bad. Power a light bulb for just over 2 days. Okay, that's the best that we can do. But then what about the glorious power of Jesus that we see here? Astronomers estimate that the number of stars, I don't know how they do this, but they estimate that the number of stars is a 3 followed by 24 zeros. I don't know how to pronounce that. I think it's like 3 trillion quadrillion, something like that. And again, I don't know where they get that number. They also say that space is endless, the universe is always expanding, so you'd think it'd be an endless amount of stars. But we'll take their number. Again, don't know what that number even means. Once you get into like millions and billions, trillions, you lose the magnitude of what it is. Just to give you an idea, 1 million seconds ago was 11 days ago. 1 billion seconds ago was like 31, 32 years ago. Okay? Some of you weren't born then. 1 trillion seconds ago was before creation, like 29,000 BC. Okay, so we're talking big numbers. So there's a lot of stars. Now, each one of those stars is emitting the same amount of power as trillions and trillions of nuclear bombs, and not in their lifetime, but every second. Okay? So your average star is producing the power of trillions and trillions of nuclear bombs every second. And there's 3 and 24 zeros stars. to take the strongest man in the world, the best that man has to offer, and it's such a small number that we can't compare it to just one of the stars that God has created. Truly, as 1 Corinthians 1:25 says, the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. So the weakest part of God, I don't know what that would be, is stronger than the strongest, the best that we have. Glad my physics degree was used for something, right? All that debt makes so much more sense now. I can calculate some watts of moving some weights around. So all that to say, God's powerful. God's powerful. When you understand all that he can do, you'll be amazed. Then verse 11 says that God strengthens us. So God strengthens us with his power. So God, in all of his power that we just described, in all of his might, strengthens little pathetic us. That should cause us to be in awe of him. He says he strengthens us for all patience and long-suffering with joy. So guys, if you want to make it, if you want to be able to suffer long, and not just make it, but do it with joy, you need to be strengthened by that power of God, and you need to recognize that incredible power. One pastor says this. He says, we prefer a God who is small, a God that we can manage, a God that we can predict and control. That kind of God feels safe to us. We can understand him and we can explain him. He doesn't confuse us or disappoint us. But this is simply not the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible is the opposite of small and manageable. He is big. He's bigger than all the words we use to say big. He defies our abilities to categorize or describe him. We want a God who is only a slightly bigger, slightly smarter version of us. But the God of the Bible is something altogether different. And here's the irony. Only a God like that is capable of sustaining our faith, igniting our passions, and giving us the confidence that we need to face suffering and hardships of the world. The God of incredible power, power that we cannot understand, strengthens us. Verse 12, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light, he has delivered us from the power of darkness and conveyed us into the kingdom of the Son of his love, in whom we have redemption through his blood and forgiveness of sins. So up to this point, we might have seen that God's mighty, that he's powerful, and it's incredible. We might wonder at his strength. But really, who cares? It still leaves us as little, as unimpressive, as incapable, leaves us kind of hopeless. Until verse 12, here God, who's great, who's powerful, who's far above us, who cannot be fathomed, humbles himself to come for little us, to qualify us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints, says to deliver us, to redeem us. This should shock us. It should shock us that a God who's up here where we can't comprehend would come down to deliver us, to redeem us, to qualify us. One, that he could even do that for us. And two, that he would be willing. It should leave us speechless. So there should be times in your life where you stop to remember what God has done, what he's saved you from, what he's taken you from, and what he's brought you to. God's done a lot for us. He's doing a lot for us. And don't forget it. And don't think of yourself as deserving of it. Instead, remember who it was who condescended, who came down to us as undeserving as we were. Then we'll live in a constant state of gratitude, thankfulness, and shock that he would care for us that much. Verse 15 says, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things consist. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he may have preeminence. For it pleased the Father that in him all the fullness should dwell, and by him to reconcile all things to himself, by him, whether things on or earth or things in heaven, having made peace through the blood of his cross." So verse 15 says that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. And then verse 19 says that it pleased God that all the fullness of him should dwell on Jesus. So it's in Jesus that we see this awesome power, glory, might of God displayed. So just think, you know, on Sundays, typically, when Justin's here, we're going through John. Think of the miracles that we've seen. Jesus has been miraculously healing people, inexplicably providing for thousands and thousands of people. He's been raising people from the dead. And we can become so familiar with these biblical stories, right, that that's all they become to us, just stories. Right? We know they're true. We wouldn't say they're not true. I know they really happened. But they lose the incredible reality of their truth, right? I mean, yeah, we believe Lazarus raised from the dead. That's incredible. But we just read it like, oh, Jesus raised someone from the dead. And then Mary and Martha, they went and did their usual thing. I wonder what we're going to talk about next Sunday. No, we just heard that Jesus raised someone from the dead. That's a big deal. A big deal. We should be amazed at what he's done. Guys, some of you have been a part of this church for a long time. Some of you have been Christians for years. Some of you have been following God for a long time. And I encourage you to not let a false familiarity with God plunder you of your awe of him. Don't let a false familiarity of who God is plunder you of your awe for him. Okay, so Jesus reveals the majesty of God, but then that also means that the Old Testament descriptions of the glory of God and the power of who he is, the immensity of him, are found true of Jesus. Verses like Psalm 145, David writing says, "I will extol you, my King, my God, and I will bless your name forever and ever. Every day I will bless you, and I will praise your name forever and ever. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise your works to another, and you shall declare your mighty acts. I will meditate on the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous work. Men shall speak of the might of your awesome acts, and I will declare your greatness. They shall utter the memory of your great goodness, and shall sing of your righteousness." Then 1 Chronicles 29 says, "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the power, and the glory, the victory, and the majesty. For all that is in heaven and in earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you have exalted us head over all. Both riches and honor came from you, and you reign over all. In your hand is power and might. In your hand it is to make great and to give strength to all. Now, therefore, our God, we thank you and praise your glorious name. But who am I, and who are my people?" That too was written by David. So you read those two things, David writing about God, and you see that it seems that David was a man who lived in realization of the wonder, might, and power of God. I'm sure he lost sight of it along the way. I don't think that the major sin he falls into, I don't think when he sinned against Bathsheba, I don't think that that was a result of him knowing the wonder power of God. But overall, his whole life, his pursuits, his thoughts, his actions are in light of the reality of God, and ours should too. So these are just two passages, the first two that I found, of the glory of God described in the Old Testament. And over, the Bible conveys the reality of the power of God, the magnificence of his name, the majesty of his glory, and over, I think we breeze by it. I think we forget. And to some extent, I don't think you can hardly blame us, right? God is beyond comprehension. Something's beyond comprehension, it means that you can't comprehend it. Okay? John Wesley once said this, "Bring me a worm that can comprehend a man, and then I'll show you a man that can comprehend the true God." So we're not going to be able to do it. I know that. I know we'll not live in constant understanding of who God is. I know we can't comprehend him fully. But we should be a group that's pushing forward and growing in our comprehension, understanding, realization of who God is. Verse 15 tells us that Jesus is the firstborn. People get really tripped up by this. And this isn't firstborn in the sense that we understand it. Jesus has always been. His existence didn't start at some time of birth, right? Christmas time. Firstborn here refers to the priority or supremacy of rank. So it's not talking about, you know, he was the first one born. No, he is top priority. He is supreme. It's saying that Jesus is of top importance. That no one and nothing should or can ever compete with him. Verse 17 reiterates that Jesus is before all things, but also that all things consist in him. Meaning that not only did he create everything, but he holds everything together. He's not just the creator, but he's the sustainer. If it wasn't for Jesus, nothing would consist. If it wasn't for Jesus, this whole world would be falling apart. The earth is going around the sun, right? We all know that. Do you know it's going around the sun at 8 times the speed of a bullet? So that's really fast. And scientists say that if just little things were changed, you know, increase, decrease speeds, increase, decrease sizes, our Earth would either be on this crash course with the sun, which is producing trillions and trillions of watts that would kill us all, or it would be careening off into space where there's no hope for life either. But it doesn't happen. And it's not going to happen because Jesus holds his creation together. Do you know that worldwide scientists spend over $1 billion a year researching this idea of what holds this earth together? Over $1 billion a year. Okay, at CERN, the particle accelerator, they're looking at all kinds of experiments to observe the inner workings of the nucleus of atoms, trying to figure out, oh, how do these nucleus hold together? And they're finding that inside of it, there's these subatomic particles, hadrons, quarks, and gluons, and more. Physics degrees helping again. And they're saying that these particles play a role in holding everything together. You know, they might be right. I couldn't tell you. They might have figured it out. But I can tell you in the end, this question that they're looking to answer, the answer that they're finding is not going to matter. They're spending millions and millions and millions of dollars looking for what holds this earth together. And guys, it's not the gluons. It's God. And knowing that answer will make all the difference. It's crazy what people will spend money researching. I was just talking to someone the other day, and I had found this study that a Harvard professor had done. He spent years researching and had significant financial backing to discover this. Human beings are terrible at predicting what will or will not make us happy, we commonly overestimate the amount of happiness something will bring. I could have told you that. Read the Bible. Read the book of Ecclesiastes. So these people in the world are spending millions and millions of dollars, years and years of their life, to discover what God has already answered right here. It's just another example of how far above us he is. You know, we're spending millions of dollars, we're dedicating our lives to find an answer to things he gave us centuries ago. Okay, God holds us all together, which is pretty cool. Jump back to verse 16. It says that Jesus created everything. It was through Jesus that everything was created. And we can't even begin to get into this glorious creation of God today. But it's breathtaking. It's incredible. There's a reason why Romans tells us that since the beginning of creation, God's qualities, his power, and nature have been on display for all to see. Hey, look around. The power of God is easily seen. Even in snowy, rainy, miserable days, you can see the power and greatness of who God is. Do you guys know that termite mounds are built so that they're naturally air-conditioned? They're climate-controlled. Like, engineers have looked at the termite mound in order to learn about airflow. We don't think highly of termites, and we're learning from them. That's how high above us God really is. Do you know that the amount of information on just one chromosome, one human chromosome, scientists say could fill 4,000 books? 4,000 books. And we're not talking like picture books, or like books, real books. It's incredible. So not only was it through Jesus that all things were created, but we see here that all things were created through him and for him. Everything was created for him. Everything. The Bible tells us that God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. Now, that isn't just said because that's the number of farms that God has control of. It's saying, no, God owns everything. He doesn't need anything from us because it's already his. Everything is his. Everything belongs to Christ. So just because I was doing a lot of math while I was preparing, I thought I'd do more math on this one and try and figure out the net worth of Jesus. So basically, I tried to calculate the net worth of the earth. To do that involved figuring out what the land is worth. So total land, you'll find, is worth... Oh, I didn't put the individual things. That would have been way more fun. But if you combine the total land, and then you look at all of the money in the earth, and then you also look at goods, you know, which you can look at by looking at the worldwide GDP, you find that the net worth of the earth, so the net worth of Jesus, would be roughly $500 trillion. Okay, and that's way beyond the net worth of, you know, number two, guy who owns Amazon, way beyond that. But then I was thinking, oh, that doesn't include people. Do you know that insurance companies have found a way to value the human life? I don't know that their number is really worth considering, but if you just take their number for fun, you find that Jesus' net worth, we're worth about $7 million each, evidently, is 600 quadrillion. Okay, 600 quadrillion. So again, number that means nothing. But if each of those dollars was a paperclip, it could go around, that paperclip chain could go around the world 560 million times. 560 million times around the entire world. Okay, so Jesus is worth a lot. Jesus is worth a lot. And that's just this stupid little joke at looking at how much it's worth. I mean, we all know that math means nothing. That's not what Jesus is worth. It's not what this earth is worth. But all that to say that Jesus is valuable. And that's just a joke, really. But the question, is he worth a lot to you? Is he valuable to you? Do you see him as more valuable than anything else? Verse 19 says that in everything, Jesus should have preeminence, right? So in everything, Jesus should be first. He should be having paramount rank, dignity, importance. He should be outstanding and supreme, nothing above him. The next chapter of this book, Colossians 2:10, tells us that we are complete in Jesus. Christians are complete in him. He's all that's needed. Do you believe it? Do you really? Does he actually get the best from you? Is he top priority? Or does he just get your leftovers? Okay, you're all here. We probably would say Jesus is important. We'd be sure that he gets a part of our life. We'd be sure that we fit him in. But is he actually at the top? Because when you esteem Christ accurately, when you see him for who he is, he's of utmost importance, utmost value. When he conflicts with something, there's no question what comes first. It's always him. It's always his calling. If you see him as valuable, as more valuable than anything else, there's nothing that you're going to hold on to so tightly that you're unwilling to let go of if he calls for it. If you see him as valuable, if you esteem him correctly, there's nothing that you'd be unwilling to let go of if he calls you to. And guys, what are we really hanging on to? I know most of you. And are we hanging on to our jobs, relationships, family, friends, romantic? Some of you, you got decent jobs. You're making some decent money. You're doing what you always wanted to do. But if you think God can blow your mind with something better, you're wrong. He could do that. Or maybe you're holding on to some type of relationship, whether family, friends, romantic, whatever. And God's told you it's time to let go. Are you really going to hang on to that friend, hang on to that person at the cost of Jesus himself? You're going to let go of Jesus, you know, the guy who created everything we just talked about, whose power is far beyond anything we can comprehend, who is valued beyond anything we've ever experienced. You're going to miss out on him for this relationship you're not willing to let go of. And I've never, you know, maybe this is true for you. I've never met this person. Maybe this is a real situation for some of you. I've never met this person, most likely. But I don't need to, because I know Jesus and I know he's worth it. I know he's worth it. He's awesome. He's great. He's glorious. He's of high value. And don't forget what he's done, right? If you're a Christian, he's died for you. But maybe you just don't see him as worth it. I promise you that he is. John Piper said this: if you don't see the greatness of God, then all things that money can buy become very exciting. If you can't see the sun, you'll be impressed with a streetlight. If you've never felt thunder and lightning, you'll be impressed with firecrackers and sparklers. If you turn your back on the greatness and majesty of God, you'll fall in love with a world of shadows and short-lived pleasures. So our God's an awesome God. He's magnificent. He's powerful. He's wonderful. Again, adjectives fail to describe, even come close to describe who he is. The question is, are we going to believe it? Are we going to trust it? Are you going to live your life in light of that fact? Because if you do, if you'll actually do this, if you'll see God as who he is, if you'll esteem Christ appropriately, then we can say farewell to the mediocre, mundane that the rest of this world knows and embrace the awe-filled life that God would have for us. It says in the book of Isaiah, verse 8 of chapter 55, which I didn't put in my notes, but I'm fairly certain it's chapter 55. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Do you believe that? Do you really believe it? That God's ways are higher than yours? And not only do you believe it, but are you going to remember it and live life as if it's true? So in closing, we're going to be, I think, singing another couple songs. And we sing songs about the greatness of God. We sing songs about God's wonder, his power, his majesty. And I don't know if we're believing it. I know sometimes I'm not. I know sometimes I'm singing, but I'm not actually seeing God as worth it. He is, so let's remember that. God, thanks for being good. Thanks for being so far beyond us. I pray that we would remember it. I would pray that we would experience your power in a way that we know that you truly are far above us, that we can't comprehend you, that we would live constantly amazed by what you've done for us. Thanks for being good to us. Amen.